That should be a very interesting night. Glenn Kimball will join us here in just a minute. The story takes a lot of twists and turns. I can't wait to get into it. It's a story that involves Nazis, a Da Vinci Code-like revelation, not to mention an ongoing concern that whoever it is that talks and promotes and publishes these documents may end up the object of a fatwa. There's a lot of academic and scholarly interest in this, a lot of universities that will be scared by the politically incorrect implications of the research, will be afraid for the professors. People who may be doing the research may have to do so under fake names to avoid terroristic threats. So explosive is the material we're about to get to next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And before I grab Glenn Kimball here, I just want to jump in and say I learn everything on Coast to Coast through trial and error. And so I was in error. I didn't realize that Ron Paul had made an appearance with George a couple of months ago. My apologies. When the caller said that, saying, you got to get Ron Paul on the show, I was still assuming that he hadn't. And I don't always hear about every show because of the nature of my work during the week. But I should have known about that one. So my bad. And glad that Ron Paul made an appearance. I wish all the candidates did. I'm still hoping for Dennis Kucinich to come on to Coast AM and talk about his UFO experiences. But that will wait for another day. Glenn Kimball is here. And what exactly is your title over at Kimball College?
Me?
Yeah. What's your title?
I guess I'm the owner.
The owner of Kimball College. Well, no, aren't you supposed to be like provost or supposed to be like, aren't you supposed to have some sort of academic title?
If you name me the provost, then I have to carry my pistols, you know.
Okay, all right. Glenn Kimball, how's your health? I heard you had a little bit of a cold this week.
Well, you get old, Ian. We are getting old, my good friend, And I have grandkids now that live around me, and they bring every disease home from
Yes.
school imaginable.
Yes.
When I lived with just me and my wife alone here, I never got sick. But the grandkids knock on my door every morning and want it their popsicle. So
Yep. They're walking Petri dishes.
They are
so,
indeed.
yep. Yeah. You got to be careful with that. So are we going to get killed if we do this show? Are we going to end up dead?
No, we're not going to end up. I can tell you right now that that possibility is very real, though. A couple of years ago, I had, after one of the shows, I had a brand new Cadillac pull up to my house outside my porch, and four guys in trench coats got out. Now, this is the summer in Arizona, and people don't wear trench coats in the summertime. They got out. One of the gentlemen had a high-def cam, and the other three had machine guns.
Oh, get out. What show was this after that they did this?
Well, I'm not going to mention it because I agreed not to.
Are
But
you serious?
I'm serious. I mean, they came out, and I waved them over. I'm the junkyard dog of history, I waved them over. I said, "Come on in, guys. I mean, don't stand out there in the heat. Let's come on in the air conditioning."
And did you see their machine guns as they got out of the car?
Absolutely.
Okay, why would they need to bring machine guns to you?
I don't know. I don't know whether
Okay.
I honestly don't know who they were because all they did was stick a high def cam in my face, and I waved at them and said some nice things, and invited them in for a beverage of their choice, and they took some video of me, and I said, "Guys, why don't you come in and spend a little bit of time? We'll have a chat." Most people would be frightened of that, but after all the things that have happened to me in my life, you run from the junkyard dog, he chases you. You sit down and pet him, he's a lot friendlier. And so that's always been my MO.
And so what did they just took some video of you and then they left?
Well, they drove about 100 feet down the parking lot, stopped and got out. And looked at me again, and I tried to wave them back, and they wouldn't come back in. They wouldn't pull back. But they did wave to me as they left.
Hmm.
Heck, I don't know what they were
That's
doing.
really weird.
It may have been a Hollywood group trying to get some sort of action sequence for Indiana Jones. I have
or
no idea.
Maybe they were looking for the next big Hollywood star, and
they
so they come in to get a quick videotape.
I think either one of us is Hollywood stars.
I'd like to hear. I'd really want to hear more about this story. It's so interesting to me, and I was so glad that you had been following the story anyway, because I was dying to find a conversation partner on this. And so you're perfect for this, Glenn. We're talking about ancient Quranic manuscripts that do not jibe with, reportedly, the text of the Quran as it is shared by billions of faithful Muslims around the world.
Well, that's true. There are really two parts that to answer that question, but to set the record straight, there are really six different versions of the Quran available. Now, if you're Islam, they don't call it versions. They call it recitations to soften that the discrepancy. But in reality, for example, these versions are very distinct. If you take the Book of the Parties, for example, the original Book of the Parties, according to people who were disciples of Muhammad himself, The Quran we have today has roughly 70 verses in that chapter under parties. The original text of the Quran, as dictated by Muhammad, had over 200 verses in it. So what happened to the rest of them?
Right.
You know, and so the version we have in our day of the Quran really comes from Uthman. Uthman was the third generation caliph after Muhammad. And he sent out an edict saying that my version is the only one available. He made five different copies of it, refused to allow anybody to read it per se. People could memorize it and recite it, but they weren't allowed to investigate it. And he sent out an edict to have all the rest of the versions of the Quran destroyed. He didn't accomplish that task perfectly, because there was a version of the Quran taken to China. There was a version taken to Kyrgyzstan up in Russia, and these are as old as the ones that were found or were authored and proposed by Uthman.
Well, then where is the threat to people who are more on the more conservative side of Islam? Why would any other version of this than coming out now? Why would this research that has just been revived in Germany with the rediscovery of an ancient text, why would that be considered any threat at all?
Well, it's the old saying that we can parallel that with the Bible. We can say that the Bible, the Christ became the flesh of the text. They say the Quran became the text of the recitation of the vision, and according to these beliefs, they believe that the Bible and the Quran were in fact the literal words of God, and that anyone messing with these words of God was messing with something extremely important. And we have to forgive them, because that process is imperfect, to say
sure.
the least.
Well, there's plenty of people that would say that today about, and then fill in the blank. I mean, whether it's the Book of Mormon, whether it's the King James version of the Bible, there are some people that believe that that is the only version of the Bible that should ever exist. It was perfect, and everything else is a corruption. I mean, there are lots of different investments that people make in arguments like that.
Yeah, and they have the Septuagint, which was the original ancient Greek version that the Nicene Council used to generate the Old Testament. And
right.
I have people contacting me all the time saying, can you give me the most original version of the Bible? And I said, do you have a copy of the Septuagint? And that's readily available on my site, and probably in bookstores around the world, if you get one that knows what they're doing. But the reality of the matter is, who cares? You know, the message is the same. We have to look at what really happened here, because there's a couple of really important secrets here that we want to talk about on this program today.
I do.
Barn burners that have to do with the Da Vinci Code, for example.
Really. Well, let's set the table then, and you choose where along the timeline you want to get started with this story, because we could go back, depending on where you want, or maybe we just start someplace and then we reserve the right to digress later on.
Well, you and I are always kind of like we sing harmony to each other's melody. So I've always felt that about you, Ian.
Well, good. Well, you do the lead vocal here. I mean, when do you start this story?
Well, let's look at who Muhammad really was, first of all. Muhammad came in the 7th century A.D. He came after the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. He came at the time when Christianity and Judaism were very separate religions, had enormous amounts of political and religious and cultural strife between them. This is the time, by the way, of King Arthur and his brother Madoc, who by the way settled in Mobile, Alabama.
Whoa. That is such a Glenn Kimball moment. King Arthur's brother settled in Mobile, Alabama.
Well, I didn't invent that. They still have the celebration there.
Okay, but how does King Arthur's brother end up in Mobile, Alabama?
Well, you and I have to do a show on that one of these days. But his brother Madoc, I mean, I'm not the travel bureau for Mobile, Alabama.
I'm not saying he made it up. I'm just saying, like, how does that happen? What year does he end up in Mobile, Alabama?
In the 6th century A.D.
Okay, so he makes it. King Arthur's brother makes it all the way to Mobile, Alabama in the 6th century.
Yeah, this is about the time of Muhammad, okay?
Okay, all right.
So we give it some context, some flavor here, okay?
All right.
We're
okay.
Talking about well before Christopher Columbus here.
Right, well, I get that part. Okay, so
It comes right in the middle of the instigation and the life expectancy of some very, very large libraries. For example, the library in Beijing, China, was found during the time of Muhammad. This library in China not only contained all the writings of Confucius and the dogmas of the Tao, but it contained an entire huge collection of the words of Jesus and his instructions to Peter and his descriptions of the Ten Commandments. We have those things in our day and age. These libraries from China, which is amazing. I mean, this is so sensational and stunning that it's going to make people wonder what in the heck we're talking about, you know. But those, my son and I have done a class on that library that exists. But that comes at the time of Muhammad's life, okay?
Right. Okay.
So Muhammad was born. His dad died when he was about just 6 months before he was born. His mother died when he was 6 years old. And so he was really basically an orphan from an itinerant family. That means a lower class family. And if you know anything about the Arabic community, they place a great deal of importance on their heritage and the power of their father and their lineage and those kinds of things. And in essence, Muhammad was left abandoned alone, an orphan. By the time he was 6 years old. So for him to have risen to be the premier figure in the Arabic world, in the Islamic world, is in itself a miraculous event.
Okay.
So he's born in Mecca. He sees all of these religions that are Arabic in nature, that they drew from India, they drew from Africa, they drew from a variety from Egypt, these mystical religions, which were often called pagan by Western Christianity, which I think is probably an inappropriate term.
Sure, it's not entirely accurate, but these would have been nomadic religions that were sometimes in conflict with each other because they might have been associated with one warlord over another warlord.
Right, and in essence, Muhammad developed mastered a great deal of money through merchant traffic. He was a camel aficionado, sold camels, launched caravans, and he was right there in Mecca, right in the throat of the traffic, the merchant traffic from the east to the west. And so this little teeny obscure town of Mecca was getting filthy rich off the trade from east to west at that particular moment in history, which is just fine. I think that's wonderful. it's honorable to have gold. You know, I wish that someone would honor me as much, you know.
Maybe that's what the guys with the machine guns were going to bring you. But anyway.
Yeah, well, right, so, next time I'm going to charge. I didn't pay him not to shoot me.
So here's what happened. So Muhammad at some point has a receives the word of God. We're not quite there yet. Okay, go ahead.
He's developed this business where he gets a lot of money and he gets a following of people who work for him in the camel business, but also who listen to his wisdom, because he speaks out against all of these mystical religions in Mecca. And in essence, is run out of town for all intents and purposes, and has to spend enormous amounts of time in Medina to the north, because the people in Mecca hated being criticized by Muhammad, because they, at that moment of time, Islam did not exist. What eventually happened, though, is he returned to Mecca, and he had a peculiar custom, which was not peculiar at all to Judaism and Christianity. He had this custom of going to these sacred places and meditating in these temple-like structures and seeing visions. Now, that's what the temples were all about. They were schools. They were places you could go and dream your dreams and have your visions and have your communication with deity. And so Muhammad was doing the very same thing that the Jews did in the Temple of Solomon, that the Egyptians did in the temples of Armana, which, by the way, were the exact replica of the Temple of Solomon. And they also, the temple in Armana in Egypt also once housed the Ark of the Covenant. We think the Ark of the Covenant was built in the deserts of the Sinai. It was not. It was built and housed in the shrines at Armana. But so Muhammad had heard about this process about how to gain knowledge. And by the way, the kinds of knowledge that you got from these visions wasn't just religious. The kinds of knowledge that you would get would be things like astronomy, mathematics, agriculture, medicine. These people were learning a great deal from these experiences. In fact, the libraries prior to one of the greatest libraries in the history of the world was the Ionian Library. It was prior to the Alexandria Library. We name an atomical particle an ion. An ion's named after these Ionian library documents, which describe atoms and electrons in a fashion that they didn't have telescope or microscopes to be able to observe. So these people, and where did they get all this knowledge from? They got it from this process that Muhammad used to discover, to learn not only about religion, but about mathematics, obviously, and all the other sciences. They had 9 different courses of studies in these places. So one night when he was in Mecca, he left Mecca, went to his favorite temple spot, had this vision of Gabriel, which was very coincidental, very parallel, because remember, it was Gabriel who announced to Joseph and Mary the coming of the birth of Jesus. It was Gabriel who taught Daniel the dreams, taught him how to interpret dreams at the time of Daniel. Gabriel's the guy who is a very common messenger for these kinds of events. And so Muhammad had this experience where it came in two parts. First of all...
Well, hang on to that. That's just going to lead us right up to where we'll break. We'll come right up to that discussion about the deliverance of the message from the Archangel Gabriel, but what if scholars can prove that the Quran was not dictated by the Archangel Gabriel to Muhammad during the 7th century, as Glenn Kimball has been telling us, but rather the Quran was assembled by later writers drawing on a variety of sources, some of which were Christian, some of which were Jewish, some of which may have come from Muhammad. What if that could ever be proven? We'll get to that coming up. That's the explosive nature of the discussion tonight and the new developments of the last week in Europe on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Let's talk with Glenn Kimball. We'll get back to the conversation coming up in just a second about Islam, about the Quran specifically. It's a story that involves Nazis. It involves the suppression of documents, not unlike the Da Vinci Code. The difference is, whereas there is room to speculate on the truth of the claims of a book like the Da Vinci Code, this could end up being something much more devastating if it's ever allowed to come out. And that's another question we'll talk about too next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So the story Glenn Kimball is telling us brings us into a very important piece of the puzzle for the developments of this week. We're talking about Muhammad's revelation from the Archangel Gabriel, as the story goes. This is the same Archangel Gabriel that we hear, you know, bringing other annunciations in the Christian Bible. So, all right, so Glenn, pick that up there then, that Muhammad says that this has been delivered to him, this resuscitation has happened, and then what happens then?
Well, during his lifetime, Muhammad was illiterate in terms of not being able to write. But he dictated this recitation to his followers, who did have scribal capability, and during his lifetime, they did write it down. That doesn't mean that the Quran that we have today is the exact same thing that was written down during his life, because Uthman, who eventually gave us what we have as the Quran today, was the third generation imam or caliph after Muhammad. And so many of the renditions that we have in our day and age really come from between 120 years and 200 years after, 280 years actually, after the death of Muhammad. But what really happened in this story is that two German archaeologists were in Yemen at the site of Sana'a, where there was a great mosque.
What year?
This is over 60 years ago. This is just before the Second World War.
Okay.
It's between the First World War and the Second World War.
And these are Nazi scientists or just scientists with
Nazi sympathizers?
Okay.
And by the way, the Germany and the Ottoman Empire had a natural alliance with each other at that point, though they were not allies during the First World War. They became allies during the Second World War because of their mutual disdain for the Jewish communities.
So because of anti-Semitism, they were joined at the hip ideologically, and Hitler was sending out scientists all over the globe trying to find things which would help the Nazi cause.
And you know what he really did? We need to back up in the story of Hitler for a moment. Even before he was a paper hanger, as he was growing up, he had the custom of going to the local pawn shop or used book dealer and trading in he was poor, he was not raised rich. He would trade in the books that he had to this mystic who owned this used bookstore, and they would trade books back and forth. And the mentor of the store would teach him about what was important. And he had all of the books, all the mystical books about alchemy. He had all the books about Christianity. He even had the stories of the Quran itself. And so Hitler gained an early appreciation for these events that happened, these processes of gaining knowledge and power. And he also knew about, I lose my tongue here for a moment.
It's okay. If I had any idea where you were going with that, I would jump in, but I don't.
The prophet of the Black Death, he had the quatrain verses.
Oh, you mean Nostradamus?
Nostradamus. Nostradamus predicted that a great man would be born at a certain day, gave the actual date of the year. And Hitler, by the way, was born on that day, and so he assumed that he was going to be the antecedent of this prophecy of Nostradamus.
I'd never heard that before.
You had never heard that before?
No, I'd never heard that Hitler had read Nostradamus, and knew that that was his birthday.
He knew very well who Nostradamus was because of his mentor, in this bookstore. And so when he went out to collect the things that would vindicate his position as the leader of the Germanic movement, or eventually the Nazi movement, they adopted the swastika. The swastika was really a symbol from India.
Yeah, Hindu, Indo-European or Hindu symbol. Yeah. It also pops up in the temples in Japan, too. It's a symbol for life, isn't it? Or
yeah. And so he didn't just pull that out of his hat. He pulled that out of his early training with this mentor of this bookstore as a symbol of his own greatness. And so one of the most important things that he did in his life was to target libraries when he went out to conquer Austria, etc. He went out to target libraries, not only great paintings and gold and those kinds of things, which would have been obvious, but he went out to collect history in order to vindicate his own cause, because he really felt like he was destined to be some sort of messianic figure, which
right.
is preposterous, obviously.
But it bolstered their mythic claims that that the Nazi Party was making and then extending through their violence, that the more violent and the more extravagant you get militarily, the more you need to be able to bolster your right to be able to do it.
That's right. And so two of these, Poonen and Botham, who were the Nazi sympathizers who were doing this excavation down in Yemen, they were tearing off the roof and almost used as insulation. They found this enormous library. This library, they called it the paper tomb. It was not the tomb of an individual, because it was very amoral for a body to be buried in a mosque, unlike in Christianity, where we can bury the popes in a cathedral or
anybody in a church that you know, under with certain traditions, can be buried in a church
or in the church courtyard. I mean, you can't even
right.
you can't be buried in a at the site of a mosque. That would be defiling it.
Right, and there's columbariums in churches, all sorts of different churches. We put the ashes or the whole body in there.
Exactly, but they did call it the paper tomb, and the reason why they called it the paper tomb is that these were the remnants of some of the very first Qurans that were in existence. Now, you have to remember that the Quran, under Uthman sent out an edict that if one of the versions, he actually made five versions, five copies. We didn't have Gutenberg's printing press at that time, so we didn't have mass market publication capability. He made five copies of them, and one of those copies, obviously, was put in the roof of this mosque in Sana'a, and along with lots of other documents. It filled 20 potato sacks, they said. And they were so extant. But to get back to this, Uthman said that if a copy of the Quran even had a hole in it or had a page missing, that it had to be destroyed, because then it was not the perfect word of God if it was missing something, okay?
Right.
But by the time of this Germanic discovery at Sana'a in Yemen, they found all of these documents, and they realized the importance of these documents, and they began to take photographs of them. They took 450 rolls of film, very long film, by the way, and took them back to Germany. And the Germans, obviously Hitler appreciated what this was. Some people say that Hitler didn't even know that they had it. It is my contention that he knew very well what he had in his possession. He didn't want to offend his Islamic allies, and so he kept them very secret.
Okay, now let's just jump in again. What is it that's so offensive about this particular, the microfilm they have of these documents? What is it that's on there that would have caused a rift between Hitler and his Muslim allies at the time?
Well, first of all, the version that was found in Yemen was a more eloquent version. It was written in the poetic style of Arabic, as opposed to a very common street style of Arabic, which is with our Quran today. It's the more common language for the people, but the more eloquent language was on these particular documents. But once again, it was their concerted opinion that this was the word of God dictated by Muhammad, and that anyone who changed even a syllable of this thing was tampering with the very word of God. And it was a great offense to them, especially to have a version that did not agree with the version of Uthman come out into the public, because it would have been a great offense to them.
And so the version that they find in this mosque is it's not an Uthman version?
No.
Okay, and it's radically different than the Uthman version, which is commonly used by the Muslim world.
I don't think it's radically different at all. I think that it's different in the sense that it's shorter, but in essence, it contains it's almost like the King James Version versus the
NIV or the
version
right?
of the Bible. For me, I wouldn't have had any problem with it, but in Islam, they had enormous problems if you changed one jot or tittle of it.
Right.
Can I give you an example of what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, please do.
The word hure, which is the word that the jihadists use when you follow the will of God and you die for the will of Allah, you know, you sacrifice your life in these bombings. They say that when you do this, that you go to heaven and get this hur, H-U-R. Now, they have interpreted it in the Al-Qaeda version as huri, with an I on the end of it. Now, huri means virgin. In other words, they claim that when they go to paradise that they're going to be given all these virgins, okay?
Right.
But the original word hur really means white or white fruit or white grapes. And that's very common. That was the most popular dictionary denotative definition of the word at the time of Muhammad. And so what Al-Qaeda has done today is they've changed that particular word to mean that if you go out and bomb yourself in the public square, that you're going to be given all these virgins or some ridiculous thing.
Okay, but wait. Now, Al-Qaeda has changed that, or in the version that exists, the common Quran that exists in any Muslim household, that it says huri in that Quran, but in the other Quran it says hur.
The Quran that we have today still says hur. They've interpreted this meaning huri.
Okay, but so the Quran today still says H-U-R.
Yeah.
So to speak. Okay. Mm-hmm. If we're going to transliterate it. Okay. So why is that different in 19, you know, pre Al-Qaeda, in pre World War II Germany? Why would a difference like that be a threat to a Muslim nation that Hitler would personally bury this version of it that was found in order to not create a rift?
You put your finger on it. For us in the Western world, there is no problem. But from an Islamic perspective, there is a problem.
Well, I was trying to think of another example that would point out the difference then pre-World War II. Were there any other examples that you've been able to find that indicate that passages, well-known passages or understandings in the modern Quran are wrong in comparison to this older version that was found?
Well, like I said, that there were some 100 passages from the Book of Parties that are missing.
Okay.
In our version that were in the original version at the time of Muhammad. So okay. The longer version is the older version.
Okay. So there are things in this other book that are there, other words that are changed, but the bottom line is the fact that it's different is a threat to the belief that the Quran that is used today is uncorrupted as opposed to the Bible, which many people in Islam would say, certainly Muhammad's opinion was, that it was a ruined version of God's word.
Yeah.
A version that was ruined by human intervention and editorializing over time, and that would seem to imply that the same thing has happened to the Quran.
Well, the Quran, as I said, had seven different versions of the Quran. We can identify seven different versions of it.
Do they know that in the Islamic world? I mean, do they openly talk about that?
They openly call it seven different renditions.
Okay.
Recitations, excuse me. Seven different recitations.
Huh. All right, so let's go back to 1938. So Hitler does bury this, and the supposedly the is either the film destroyed or what happens to this film of this Koran? What do we know about it?
The film's still there. They still have copies of the photographs.
Yeah, I know, but supposedly didn't Hitler order it destroyed? And then it wasn't, and I thought I remember. I'm going to go back. I'm going to pull up this.
He did.
The article. What's that?
He did. But it's still in existence. The copies of the photographs still are in existence, and you can find it on the net in some different places. Actual photographic copies of the Sana manuscripts.
Okay, and so now we have sort of a unique. We can take a moment here. This parallels. The kind of thing you're up against all the time, right? I mean, you as a researcher of lost ancient documents, this is a very familiar story.
It's an old story, enormously familiar to me. As I told Art Bell 10 years ago, we were tracking 5 million documents that dealt with Jesus, were either written by Jesus, his apostles, disciples, or people who knew him. That sounds like a preposterous claim, but unfortunately it's not preposterous at all. John said it best in John 21:25. He says, "And many things Jesus did, I suppose, if they were all written, the world itself could not contain all the books that should be written." Probably a very similar thing on a minor scale is true with the Quran. All the books that should be written about the Quran would be enormous, about the history of Muhammad. There are six different versions of his life, for example, that vary and tell us different stories. There are people that say that he actually visited Jerusalem and had this vision of the ascension with Gabriel, which came in two parts. Most of the real historic world believes that he didn't get there at all, but it's my opinion that he probably did. He probably did get to Jerusalem. After all, he was a camel merchant, involved in merchant traffic and trade. That's how he made his life.
Sure.
And it would not have been uncommon for him to have traveled a short distance to Jerusalem and have known very well about the Temple Mount.
Right. Very interesting. Now, and that's, again, though, it comes down to, you know, things like that. It doesn't sound terribly surprising, or to the Western ear, it's not controversial to hear alternate views of the life of Jesus, or to discuss what aspects of the New Testament might or might not be true, historically accurate, what might have gotten shifted, any of that sort of thing. It's not an uncommon discussion in the West.
In our day and age, that's true, but that's not always been the case now.
No, that's a good point.
At the time of the Nicene Council, and up until just 150, 200 years ago, the reading of the Bible was banned.
Well, let's go ahead and then take this back, though, after the top of the hour, to what's going on right now with this document and why this is this alternate Quranic document that has been rediscovered after it had been reportedly destroyed, that this document is causing so many ripples in the academic community. What is it exactly that's going to happen with this document? Nobody knows for sure, but we'll run down some of the most recent developments about it and who's fighting to still keep it suppressed. Next, with the Glenn Kimball. I will tell you, too, at coasttocoastam.com, I put the blog up from earlier this evening from Crypto News. If you want to click onto that, if you missed the Crypto News stories, they're right there at coasttocoastam.com. And I'm looking forward, too, to Glenn Kimball's conversation here about this Quranic development vis-a-vis Indiana Jones next on Coast to Coast AM.